Typical images of the first opposite, sun. I don't think that's too hard to imagine. The sun is bright and the moon is dark. The sun is hot and blinding, as you are experiencing back there, where the moon is gentle and subtle. So these opposites, sun and moon, they could stand for just about any pair of opposites in you. But where there's a contrast that has to do with bright and dark or masculine and feminine, these could be what your dreams use to symbolize. The value for somebody like myself doing this work is that you are alerted when you see these things to think, ah, we're dealing with the opposites. One thing he says there about soul, I'll just mention. Soul, sun, soul is just Latin for sun, can either represent one principle of consciousness, or it can represent the self. That's a little bit outside of our scope for the moment, but it's not too hard to imagine when you realize the job of the ego is to reflect the self, as we've talked, that this real person in us has to try to come in harmony with the way we actually live. So sometimes the sun can represent one of the opposites, sometimes it can represent the goal, and it would depend on the context. The lion is something we'll talk about in the next time we meet. Next time we meet, we will talk about the opposites of the king and the queen as representing the two opposites. And we'll talk about the opposite symbolized by Adam and Eve. And then we'll talk about what does the unified condition look like. That will be our agenda for next time. So next time we'll look at the lion. Sulfur is very interesting. It would represent the masculine principle, it would represent soul, and let's look at what Jung has said about it, and I'll try to explain it. Sulfur represents the active substance of the sun, or in psychological language, the motive factor in consciousness. On the one hand, the will, which can best be regarded as a dynamism subordinated to consciousness, in other words, you can control your will, and on the other hand, a...
You can.
Well, then it would be compulsion.
Yeah.
An involuntary motivation or impulse ranging from mere interest to possession proper. The unconscious dynamism would correspond to sulfur, for compulsion is the great mystery of human life. It is the thwarting of our conscious will and our reason by an inflammable element within us, appearing now as a consuming fire and now as a life-giving warmth. So these situations which I have described to you, where there is lust, or there is passion, or there is desire, or there is a marriage triangle, or there is great resentment, all of that would be symbolized by sulfur, where you are burning. And not necessarily happy to be burning, but burning anyway. And the problem of that generally is it functions out of what you generally wish for your life. So it's not felt as necessarily a benevolence, but you're possessed by it anyway. And you're stuck with the fact that you can't get rid of it, but if you live it out concretely in the wrong way, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble and destroy things that are dear to you. So sulfur is often the beginning of this alchemical process, in that it is what leads you to these worldly situations that you have to extract things from. So sulfur would be crude desire. There is a refined sulfur in alchemy, which would be when that crude fire has been transformed into a higher level of cultural living, but generally where it nails us is in passion and desire that is compulsive or overpowering. So that's the sun. I've gone through many paragraphs, many very quickly. Jung gives a gazillion examples of different versions of the sun, different elements used to personify the sun. But basically, we've got an active, masculine, driving side that is one pole of this conflict that is found. The other is the moon. And the moon would be the receptive, the feminine, the hidden, the quiet, the secretive, as opposed to the lethal and devouring light and desire of the sun. Where the sun is loud, the moon is quiet. It's I gave you a little quote there, not either from Edinger or from Jung, but just a general description of the moon as what regenerates in darkness. So you see, if sulfur and the moon can get together, what you are able to do is transform that burning into something creative. If the synthesis can be faced, can be dealt with after the opposites are accepted. The animal that's typically attracted to the moon is the dog. Why? Let me show you some. These are pretty much the same pictures, but just to remind you how the opposites are symbolized male and female, sun and moon. See sun and moon. Sun and moon. Sun and moon. There's the moon. The dog would represent the dark side of the moon. Now, what's that mean? The dog as a howling animal would represent the gnawing, depressing, biting thoughts you have in this process. On the light side, the moon would be the positive, genteel dimension of receptiveness and relationship. On the dark side, it would be the gnawing and discomforting and thoughts that eat at you, that bite at your heel and don't let you go. And all of that has to be reckoned with in this process.
Okay.
Yes?
Is that part that we've been putting into the shadow in our
world? Well, certainly I think in our culture it is the no-no. One of my favorite heroes, Arthur Miller, called America the culture of the superlative, where everything has to be great. See, there's no room for a dog in a culture where you have to always be upbeat and on top of things.
So it's the unpositive in our positive culture.
It's the apparently unpositive. It is not, if you realize what it is doing, is trying to guide you through your dissatisfaction to what is satisfying. But if you cut out what tells you you're dissatisfied, you never get to where you're satisfied. I really have to give a plug to the IRT. They're putting on Death of a Salesman now. I thought it was one of the best plays I've ever seen, and I am not a theater critic, so I kind of bit my tongue, but I've got some friends who are actors, professional actors, and a couple of those guys said to me, this is the best play Arthur Miller ever wrote, it is the best American play, and it is the best play they've ever performed at the IRT, so if you get a chance, go see it. It is a man possessed by the dog. He is constantly eaten up by his negative thoughts. Again, needn't be negative an outcome if you can stop and think, oh, this is what I don't want. And I will stay with what I don't want until I get what I do want. But we're trained to think, oh, now, you know, if you're given lemon, make lemonade. Instead of saying, well, it's a lemon, I think I'll look for oranges somewhere else. Yeah. And so the dog is dog has many meanings. It doesn't have to mean this. See, already I'm apologizing. But it can mean this. Yeah.
Say a little more about one. You said the death of the salesman is eaten by the negative thought.
Yeah.
And then you said you can't make lemonade out of it. You could go with oranges somewhere else. And then a little while we were talking about stewing in it for a while. somehow that feels...
I'm saying the same thing.
That we don't stew.
We don't stew.
You just be in it.
Be in it,
but
yeah.
But don't let it drive you.
Right. Like Willie, I mean, I don't want to get off on it too much, but Willie, you know, is miserable the whole time. And he's given a second chance. And he passes it by. Because he's got to get back into the old paradigm. Rather than say, you know, the reason I've been miserable is that my life isn't what I want it to be. I think I'll make a change. He can't do that. Instead, I won't ruin it if you haven't seen it, but...
Well, and that is so vividly portrayed in the two sons. How they are responding to the life that they find themselves in that family.
Yeah.
You know, one conscious that he...
Oh, she hasn't seen it.
I'm not saying anything, but one's very conscious of it in that, and one is just living the same life.
Yeah. It's a powerful, and it's really a man caught by a howling dog who can't hear it. Because he's obsessed with the great American dream. And the great American dream is about all sun. Everything's bright, positive, so on. Okay, so it's a very quick tour, but I thought, you know, what are you going to do with 6,000 images of the king? Just to give you a taste of how Jung, and if you're reading this, you'll hear many examples of dogs, many examples of sulfur, many examples of the moon. All he's doing is adding other images to broaden out knowledge for people who are working with either their own unconscious or somebody else's. Here's how these opposites are likely to appear. They don't often come with little signs on them. We're the opposites. You have to know the variety of possible means of expression if you're going to recognize where the conflict is, then help the people become aware of it. Let's go now to a text of Jung. Up to now I've pretty much tried to spoon feed you with Edinger's summary, but here is Jung's working on a text. I put the text in here. First, I think it's beautiful. Second, it deals with dogs. It doesn't deal with dogs directly, but once you know the mythological background, you can see it's about dogs. And I'll read you the text, which is a literal quote from an alchemical manuscript of probably the 16th century. And then what I've gone through is I've just tried to extract Jung's basic comments on each sentence. But they're Jung's direct quotes. So here's the text. If thou knowest how to moisten this dry earth with its own water, thou wilt loosen the pores of the earth. Remember, it's a recipe again. And this thief from outside will be cast out with the workers of wickedness. And the water, by an admixture of the true sulfur, will be cleansed from the leprous filth and from the superfluous dropsical fluid. And thou wilt have in thy power the fount of the knight of Treviso. That's the name of an alchemist, whose waters are rightfully dedicated to the maiden Diana. Diana's animal is the dog. You see, that's how the dog gets in here. Diana is Artemis in Greece, and the huntress. Worthless is this thief, armed with the malignity of arsenic, from whom the winged youth fleeth shuddering. And though the central water is his bride, yet dare he not display his most ardent love towards her because of the snares of the thief, whose machinations are in truth unavoidable. Here may Diana be propitious to thee, who knoweth how to, it should be tame, typo, how to tame wild beasts, and whose twin doves will temper the malignity of the air with their wings, so that the youth easily entereth in, and it should be through, easily entereth in through the pores, and instantly shaketh the foundations of the earth, and raise up a dark cloud. But thou wilt lead the waters up even to the brightness of the moon, and the darkness that was upon the face of the deep shall be scattered by the Spirit moving over the waters. Thus by God's command shall the light appear. That's a direct quote from an alchemical recipe. Shall we go through it, reading it sentence by sentence again in the interpretation, or do you feel you have the text in your mind? Go through the passage, because it's not exactly sensible. So I've tried to number the sentences, that's my numbering, and then give Jung's comment on the next page to each sentence. So I will read. If thou knowest how to moisten this dry earth with its own water, thou wilt loosen the pores of the earth. It should be loosen. So on page 7, under 1, here's Jung's commentary. If you will contemplate your lack of inner aliveness and impregnate it with the interest born of alarm at your inner death, then something can take shape in you, for your inner emptiness conceals just as great a fullness if only you will allow it to penetrate into you. You hear how that's putting, in other words, what we've already said, focus in on the darkness that you're dealing with in a given experience. Don't run from it. Let it be and give your attention to it. And this thief from outside will be cast out with the workers of wickedness. Back to page 7. Number 2, something like an evil spirit has stopped up the foundation of your soul. The enemy is your own crude sulfur, so your desirousness, which burns you with the hellish fire of desirousness or concupiscencia. Concupiscencia is Latin for unbridled desire. You no longer even want to be fruitful, as it would be for God's sake, but unfortunately not for your own. Of course, that's said ironically. That what the text is pointing out is how we get tied to the outcome of our work instead of seeing it as in the service of a higher principle, and that because of our greed. So you tend not to work on the unconscious because you say, what good is it, rather than just working on it for its own sake and then watching what it gives you back. And the water, by an admixture of the true sulfur, will be cleansed from the leprous filth and from the superfluous dropsical fluid. Jung writes, therefore, away with your crude and vulgar desirousness, which childishly and short-sightedly sees only goals within its narrow horizon. I think that's the key thing. Goals within its narrow horizon. I will have this, I will have this, I will have this, no matter what the larger meaning of that might be for your life. He's not talking against desire. He's talking against desire that has no sense of what it's doing to you. Admittedly, sulfur is a vital spirit. So admittedly, desire is important. Useful as it is at times, it is an obstacle between you and your goal. The water of your interest is not pure. It is poisoned by the leprosy of desirousness, which is the common ill. You are too infected with this collective sickness. What is behind all this desirousness? A thirsting for the eternal. For desire burns in order to burn itself out, and in and from this fire arises the true living spirit, which generates life according to its own laws and is not blinded by the short-sightedness of our intentions or the crude presumption of our superstitious belief in the will. Now, again, I don't think he's talking about not wanting things, but what he's driving at is when you want something and you can't get it, that you keep blindly seeking after it, ignoring all indications to the contrary. That's the crude sulfur. Again, I will have it, even though things are not working out, even though reasonable consideration says you can't have it. You persist in that relationship or that higher job or that bigger car, something like that.
Well, even if you get it, you don't get what you want. It's never said
out. Right, right, right. And so then this text could apply to the emptiness that you feel when you do have it. when you have gotten what you thought you wanted. And see, again, this, I think, such a very important phrase, the true living spirit. What the point of this, often of these desirous experiences are, is to get to that inner guidance, which Jung is here calling the true spirit. There is a real guidance for your life embedded in the experience if you can work with it and stop pursuing it so single-mindedly. Then you say, okay, I give up getting it. I can't get rid of the desire for it, so I will live with that desire and I will turn it over to my dreams and see how they show me what the meaning of the thing is. After you've tried and failed, then you can do that. Because what's at stake very often is Jung's next comment. The unconscious demands your interest for its own sake and wants to be accepted for what it is. So the experience often leads you to turn back to yourself because there is a message in it, as we've discussed. Once the existence of this opposite is accepted, the ego can and should come to terms with its demands. Unless the content given you by the unconscious is acknowledged, its compensatory effect is not only nullified, but actually changes into its opposite as it then tries to realize itself literally and concretely. So you continue seeking more directly for the thing which you have not been able to get, and generally then with disastrous consequences. Okay. Then point number 4 on page 6. And thou wilt have in thy power the fount of the night of Treviso, whose waters are rightfully dedicated to the maiden Diana. His comment is, the ever-flowing fountain expresses a continual flow of interest towards the unconscious, a kind of constant attention or religio, religio here meaning one possible etymology of the word religion, is to pay constant attention to, which might be called devotion. This is Jung's understanding of what devotion is. If attention is directed to the unconscious will yield up its contents, and these in turn will fructify the conscious like a fountain of living water. All of that, when you cease giving up compulsively what is not granted to you, and begin to try to understand what its meaning is. Worthless is this thief, armed with the malignity of desire, arsenic, from whom the winged youth fleeth shuddering. The thief personifies a kind of self-robbery. He is not easily shaken off, as it comes from a habit of thinking, supported by tradition and milieu alike. Anything that cannot be exploited is uninteresting, hence the devaluation of the psyche. So that old adage, he who dies with the most toys wins, starts gnawing at us, and we're back to the old. The thief is contrasted with the winged youth, who represents the other aspect or personifies the true sulfur, the spirit of inner truth, which measures man not by his relation to the mass, but by his relation to the mystery of the psyche. The shy and delicate youth stands for everything that is winged in the psyche, or that would like to sprout wings, but it dies from the poison of organizational thinking and mass statistics. The individual succumbs to the madness that sooner or later takes over every mass, the death instinct of the lemmings. A lemming is a bird that when one jumps off a cliff, they all do. The winged youth would be that way of living which is the fulfillment of what you are really seeking, what your real talents are, what a real relationship is, what a real home is. As opposed to following that, we are seduced into seeking illusory goals of power, prestige, accumulation, and so on. And though the central water is his bride, yet he dare not display his most ardent love toward her, because of the snares of the thief, whose machinations are in truth unavoidable. The goal of the winged youth is a higher one than the fulfillment of collective ideals. A person's life is the soul in which his soul can... Sorry, it's the soil. Is the soil in which his soul can and must develop. He has only the mystery of his living soul to set against the overwhelming might and brutality of collective conditions. I can do no more than demonstrate the existence of this image, the winged youth, and its phenomenology. I think an important sentence now. If a person no longer sees the meaning of his life in its fulfillment, and no longer believe in man's eternal right to this fulfillment, then he has betrayed and lost his soul, substituting for it a madness which only leads to destruction, as our time demonstrates only too clearly. So the fulfillment of your own life is what that winged youth stands for, what will really be satisfying, the profession that will really be satisfying, whether it gets you attention or not, the relationship that will really be satisfying, no matter what's pizzazzy or not, the home that will really be where life occurs, whether it's a McMansion or not. Here may Diana be propitious to thee, who knows how to tame wild beasts. The darkness which is opposed to the light is the unbridled instinctuality of nature that asserts itself despite all consciousness. The tender pair of doves, now back to our opposites, the tender pair of doves is obviously a harmless aspect of the same instinctuality. Together they represent the attack first from the one side and then from the other of a dualistic being on the more restricted consciousness of man. The purpose of or result of this assault is the widening of consciousness. The one after another is a bearable prelude to the deeper problem of the side-by-side, for this is an incomparably more difficult problem. The instincts are what are shuttling you back and forth, and the dove would be the message that is to come to you, like we saw here, the wisdom out of the conflict that you are dealing with as you stay true to it. And he says harmless because that's the beneficial aspect of the experience if you know how to get the wisdom out of being tossed back and forth between the opposites. So that the youth easily entereth in through the pores and instantly shaketh the foundations of the earth and raises up his clouds. It is the prefiguration and anticipation of a future condition in which you are living a meaningful life. But thou wilt lead the waters up even to the brightness of the moon. As we have seen here, water means, has the meaning of fructifying interest. And the darkness that was upon the face of the deep shall be scattered by the Spirit moving over the waters. Thus by God's command shall the light appear. And Jung's comment is, the eye that hitherto saw only darkness and danger of evil turns toward the circle of the moon, where the eternal realm of the immortals begins, and the gloomy deep can be left to its own devices, for the Spirit now moves it from within, convulses, and transforms it. Spirit, again, being the knowledge of how your life is to develop. Yeah?
Another question. Did the alchemists, were they purposely writing in this convoluted way, or did they not have the psychological development to say it more simply? Because, in other words, Jung had to go through an awful lot of study to be able to speak it in stuff that was close to consciousness. Is that what was going on? In other words, it was a developmental thing to be able to...
I think it was a mixture of both. They did not understand linear thinking. They did not understand what we would call epistemological criticism, that, well, that's the basis of science, that you know, if you close the door and John sneezes, I could say, well, the door caused John to sneeze. Now, a scientist would say, well, close it again and see if he sneezes. If there is that relationship, then that is cause and effect. But they weren't there yet.
Okay.
That just hadn't entered their mind. It's incredible to think that it didn't, but it didn't. And so I think that's part of it. On the other hand, they sort of saw themselves as kind of an elite, not economic elite, but that they were in possession of the truth. And so they didn't want to share this stuff. So their recipes were intentionally vague so that the undevoted would not understand them. So I think it's a mixture of both.
Wasn't there some deliberate attempt to camouflage it due to persecution by the church?
Yeah, that would be, you said it too straight that the church
was... Well, I don't think so, because many of these guys were preachers.
Yeah, that they were being heretics and giving them...
Yeah.
I thought it was like a secret society.
I think it's more of a secret society.
But they also thought they might be witches or evil.
Yeah. Magic. But what is so amazing, and why I don't think it's, I don't know for sure, but why I think that is not the main reason, is nobody recognized this was a heresy. They were preaching on Sunday morning, and in the week, they were making Christ in the test tube. Sometimes that gold was thought to be appearance of Christ on earth. Well, if Christ had done his job, what are they doing making him? So this never occurred to them, that if the worldview they were espousing worked, why bother with this?
Well, I think that goes back to this idea of consciousness, because I took a class, an introductory departmental class quite some time ago, and they were talking about that they thought that the ego as an organ of consciousness really began to develop with the Renaissance.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So that the you know, what we call the ego, the one we've got now, is was not what we had then. That there's been this developmental thing that's happened.
I mean the science and enlightenment produced an enormous shift in consciousness, where we began to realize cause and effect. You know, if you drink bad water, you get malaria. Mm-hmm. That was never recognized before. So there is a tremendous gift to our consciousness from these movements. But at the same time, then all of this was said, well, that's bunk. And they threw the baby out with the bathwater. So Jung is trying to go back to it, not as a literal truth always, but just what were the gems hidden in this material that we need to recover. But we have to always remember that we're dealing with a medieval mind that did not understand cause and effect.
Well, we see that, at least in the translation of the Bible that we're left with, the whole thing about Jesus telling the apostles and the disciples that they're speaking parables, because the apostles and the disciples were given special knowledge, but the common people wouldn't understand it, so they had to be taught in parables, or they call figures.
Right. Okay, one more picture, and then we can see what we want to do. This next picture is so important, I want to spend some time on it. I jumped ahead. Let me just mention salt first before I do this. I'll just read you what Jung has written about salt, and then explain it, and then the segue to the picture. We talked about sulfur as desire. Salt has two meanings, bitterness or wisdom. Jung writes, apart from its lunar wetness and its terrestrial nature, the most outstanding properties of salt are bitterness and wisdom. So this is the alchemist saying, I mean, we're reading Jung here, but Jung is referring to the alchemist who said salt can either represent bitterness or wisdom. Tears, sorrow, and disappointment are bitter, but wisdom is the comforter in all psychic suffering. Indeed, bitterness and wisdom form a pair of alternatives, Where there is bitterness, wisdom is lacking, and where wisdom is, there can be no bitterness. The point there, the relationship, somebody asked me, what's the relationship between sulfur and salt? Sulfur leads you into an experience. That's the desire that leads you into something. When it doesn't work out, you get salt. You're bitter. You wanted something, and you don't get it. So the masculine and the feminine work in this unconscious way, in that desire very often leads to bitterness, because you don't get what you want. If you reflect on that in the way we've been discussing here and can extract the meaning out of the experience, again, going back to our extraction model, you become wise. That's how salt can represent either bitterness or wisdom. So you have to allow your sulfur to move you to life, your desire. Jung is always very worldly. Move you into life and seek for what you want. And if you don't get what you want, then you turn back to yourself and you say, why? What is the meaning of this? And until you find the meaning, your sulfur will have produced salt as bitterness because you didn't get what you want. And when you do understand the meaning, you will have another piece of yourself, and that is wisdom.
It's interesting that sulfur and salt in the body, sulfur is one of the things that's used in the joints to make your joints move. If you don't have enough sulfur, you get rickety. You don't move easily. And if you don't have enough salt, you die. Or if you have too much salt, you die. So, and literally, we have to have the salt. And it makes us sweet, you know. In other words, when you taste something with salt in it,
it adds a little bit of spice to life, right?
Yeah, it's that.
That picture. What does this have to do with?
This is a picture from an alchemical text where at the bottom of the picture, a winged creature, a monstrosity, is being lifted out of a lump of some unknown substance by a human-looking figure whose head is a halo. On the upper level, we have the the father. It's not clear whether this is the father and this is the son, but one of these is the father, this perhaps is the father, and that's perhaps the son. That's the Holy Spirit, and that's Mary. We have a depiction of what the Pope declared in 1950 as dogma, namely the bodily ascension of Mary into heaven. Jung thought that was one of the most important developments of the last century, that declaration. Because what it did was it made the spiritual principle, it made the feminine principle sacred, where before it was excluded, so that the God image went from a trinity, transformed from a trinity to a quaternity. And the missing element is included. Now, that's important because most early religions depict God in multiples of four. But Christianity cut out one portion of it, matter in the feminine, and only deified a part of life, which left this whole question of the meaning of our relationship to the earth undefined. The alchemical picture juxtaposes these two things, the extraction from matter and the coronation of the feminine principle in matter as sacred, completing the God image of our Christian religion by adding the missing element. What this had to do with salt, that lump would refer to the lumpiness of life, which is what salt is. It's that those parts of life that leave us shaken and bitter. And what we've talked about in this extraction model is how do you extract meaning out of those experiences. And that's depicted on the bottom. The top pictures suggest that there, as you do that, there is a shift in religious consciousness that is also going on. That is at the same time a transformation of our understanding of what is sacred. In Jung's language, that's the transformation of the God image. That on one level, working with the meaning of difficult experiences of life is at the same time producing a transformation in our understanding of what God is, suggesting now that that lower scene is what is the sacred task of our time.
Where is that?
This picture? I don't know if I have it. It's an alchemical text from a text called Pandora by Reusner, R-E-U-S-N-E-R. I've given you the reference here from the collected works. Jung refers to it in paragraph 238. Let me just read you a couple of Edinger sentences summing this up. The assumption of the Virgin Mary symbol, the Virgin Mary, symbolizes the assimilation of the materiality principle to the Western psyche. Does that make sense? The assumption of the Virgin Mary symbol symbolizes the assimilation of the materiality principle into the Western psyche. See, up to now, we have not seen matter as sacred. The spirit has been sacred, but not matter. So the assumption of the feminine, Mary, because she is the feminine is associated with Earth, Mother Earth, and because Christianity has been entirely spiritual, would represent that is changing. That we there is a movement within ourselves to make a new dimension of life sacred. Sorry? I think they already take matter as sacred.
Yeah.
Right. Right. East. Well, that's difficult. You see, I think part of the problem in answering the question is that Islam today has about as much to do with the essence of Islam as Christianity today has to do with the essence of Christianity. It was Jung's feeling that the essence of Islam did not split spirit and matter. That the essence of Islam is a religion of love and of material. Not materialism, but appreciation of the material. Now, that really puzzled me. Until I realized who is the most articulate Middle Eastern poet? Rumi. What does Rumi talk about? Love and the flesh as a vehicle to God. So I think if you take it in that sense, no, the East isn't, the Middle East isn't separate. Yes, what Islam has become is, but the essence of the tradition isn't.
In some ways, they do treat the feminine as sacred within
what
one owns.
Yeah.
And particularly some sort of strange
manifestation.
Yeah. You know, we do too.
Yeah, there. If you listen to the Islamic, I'm not trying to justify what they're doing, but if you listen to the Islamic critique of Christianity, it's that we render under Caesar what is Caesar's, and under Christ what is Christ's.
and they don't see that. They see the whole thing as sacred. Now, I don't particularly care for the way they go about it, but there, with at least within their criticism of us, they are criticizing our split between spirit and matter.
Well, here's a thought, back to the bottom of page 7.
The person
no longer sees the meaning of his life in its fulfillment and no longer believes in a man's eternal right to his fulfillment, then he has betrayed and lost his soul, substituting for it a madness which only leads to destruction.
Yeah.
And I think the dominance of the Western point of view has made a lot of youth in the Middle East feel like they've lost their soul and they are possessed by the madness in the destruction.
They don't want our strip malls.
No, no. So they're reacting to, so it's, you know, it's the very thing that's here. So what we're seeing, if you don't get to the peace and you want it, then you can be explosive in the destruction. Mm-hmm. You know,
the thing you just made, they don't want our strip malls. Go to any affluent area, they want the strip malls. That's what they want.
Who does?
In the Middle East. Well, look what's being built in all the successful areas of the Middle East, and what everybody wants to go to. They want, you know, they're just as much a sucker for materialism as we are when it comes down to it.
But remember, these are all the fundamentalists are the ones who are dreaming the activism, and we've got the weirdo fundamentalists over here doing the same thing.
They want the strip mall stuff, and when you go, you want to see, they still want to maintain separation.
I don't know if the fundamentalists want the strip malls. I don't think they do.
Culture, society, they do.
Oh, but remember that Islam as a culture isn't fundamentalist. We're talking about Islamic fundamentalism here.
The other side of it is that now with this global warming thing, more and more of the right-wing Christians in this country are beginning to talk about the human's responsibility of taking care of God's a creation, whereas before they felt that they could take advantage of it. So there is a clear shift in some of the more strong religious focus on Christianity of taking care of it, so that beginning to see it as sacred, but only at the point where it's ready to be withdrawn. So
you lost me in that last part there.
Global warming. In other words, we're
on the
edge of the planet, and now they're beginning to say, "Oh, well, no, wait a minute. Maybe we've got to start taking care of it." But it is happening. Where, you know, and I think that's what we're talking about. This Mary's assumption. It took a while for it to be absorbed, but it's beginning to happen.
Remember, this is a medieval picture.
Yeah.
1950, the dogma was pronounced. But I think Jung feels that this is so relevant to our age because we are being directed back to matter through global warming, and simply the fact that fewer people are willing to listen to thou shalt, and they want the pleasures of the body, and by God they're going to get them. And he doesn't say that's necessarily a bad thing, but what it leads us to is the necessity to extract meaning out of it as a way of not burning ourselves up, and that is at the same time a shift in religious consciousness. So that this is the religious task of the time, he feels.
And it's the physical experience that is driving the change of the spiritual attitude. It's the global.
The physical has become the mouthpiece of the spiritual.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. That is Jung in a nutshell. Physical has become the mouthpiece of the spiritual. It's become the mouthpiece of the spiritual. I mean, think about what we've been doing here. The opposites are, your own inner conflict, but you only get to know that when you've collided with reality. Otherwise, you're in happy la-la land. As long as you don't have a conflict with reality, how would you ever face them? And the extraction model is extracting from material experience and your desire for your place on this earth what the meaning is. Both of them start with material. We don't stop with material, but if we don't start with material, then we don't get to the spirit. And Jung feels that this spirit is a genuine, valid experience, and perhaps it has changed its mind this is Ion, which we will get to eventually, since the birth of Christ, and it is now coming to us through the material. That's why this link up of the lump, extracting Mercurius up out of the lump, that's what initiates the process of transformation, and that is tantamount to a shift in religious consciousness.
Where did you say this came from? Who's the author, you said?
I think it's Reus. I don't know it, John. Reusner, R-E-U-S-N-E-R. Do you have any of these books? I think I gave you the page reference. Mysterium Lectures, page 132, and Jung, paragraph 238. It's a medieval text.
Could you say one more time what the shift is in my head because
it's late. Yeah, that he's just looking at this picture and he's noticing Mercurius extracted from matter, which is what we've been talking about, right? That's okay. And that is depicted in the same woodcut as the coronation of the Virgin. The coronation of the Virgin would symbolize that the feminine Mother Earth material principle is now being recognized as sacred, and that our image of God will change to include that element in the future. And that they are really two sides of the same coin. So that the religious task today is just what is depicted below. That we face the material world as our starting point and allow it to be the vehicle for our coming into contact with this guiding spirit. That is the religious task. You hear a lot of talk among certain people about, uniting religion and psychology. It's already been united. It's called Jungian psychology. Because the religious task is extracting the spirit out of earthly experiences. And that's the methodology that Jung tried to develop. How do you do that? Well, we've seen two basic principles. You live with your conflict. You focus on your conflict. You put the energy there until such time as it changes. And that you take seriously your desires. You follow them into a situation in life. When that leads you to frustration, then you stop. You don't pursue it obsessively, but you stop. You turn back and you ask yourself, what is the meaning? In other words, you turn your bitterness into wisdom. And that those two operations, that we begin to live that way, is the religious task. The religious task is no longer going to church. The Mass is no longer in church. The Mass is right here in the way we live our life.
And notice that she's the center of that, and everything revolves around.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's another point that says this now is the center of the psyche, is the crown feminine, not the masculine anymore.
Right, absolutely. And I think that says to me that the important challenge today is this feminine process, that we have to put that above everything else. That's the central challenge. Turning material to spirit, so to speak. Jane?
Can you say something about that? I missed it. On the birds that was the...
they're the four evangelists. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
I can really see. That's Mark, John, Matthew, Luke.
And those are the four fixed signs. Remember, we started with the four cardinal signs. Those are the symbols of the four fixed signs.
But it's this equivalent, which is so important.
Is the halo a symbol for the spiritual nature?
Well, what Edinger makes of that is what he calls the Christified ego. What do you mean?
Christified or defined?
Christified.
Christified. Oh, okay.
To put it in language for those of you who've been digging around Jung for a while, it's an ego that's in touch with the self. It's an ego that is seeking to find a greater pattern for our life. And when we do that, this is the same reason the sun is the symbol of the self and the and consciousness. Our consciousness is reshaped in the form of the self. And since the self is often symbolized by God images, that adds a level of depth to the ego, symbolized here by the halo.
Thank you. It'll be the second coming.
Well, Jung thinks it is the second coming.
Yeah, which is about the manifestation of the spiritual into the physical.
In material, as each individual wrestles with this experience. So you see, not only, now, you know, you can't get into this very far before you start seeing how it shoots out. We talked about its implications for history, which we will turn to in the seminar we do on Ion. As you can see, this has enormous complications for theology. So we will spend one whole day on the theological implications of this material. That's the very, I think, next to the last one.
Interestingly enough, there's that big controversy now with that film and book out about finding the tomb of Jesus. That maybe he didn't rise, maybe he had a son. So here we go to the movement literally into the physical. You know, with some,
or maybe this is the tomb of Jesus, and it's about time we let him emerge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I tell you the vision of the priest and the witnessing the resurrection of Christ. Didn't I tell you that last time? That'd be a good place to end. Speaking of materiality and her, I saw a priest once who dreamt that he was to witness the resurrection of Christ. Does that sound familiar? Some of you probably heard it in the class. One of the classes we did, I remember. And so crucified Christ was brought in the coffin. The coffin lid arose, and Christ arose. And she was a woman. And she wanted to make love. And he ran. So that is another example that the sacred moments of life now are to be between the sexes, thrashing out life in time and space. And that is what is sacred now. Well, I think we've done it. Thank you. We are still trying to figure that out.
We're still trying to figure out location, but Gary, have you chosen
dates? Oh, did we choose the dates? Oh, okay. Do you remember what they were?
I think it's like September 29th or something like that, about September 28th. Does that sound right?
Yes. Do you have everybody's email? It'll be in the next newsletter. It'll be in the
newsletter.
End of September, end of October.